My name is Meg Galastinos, and I am a partner in our career business at Mercer. And it is my honor to represent Mercer here today as a proud sponsor of the 2018 Silicon Valley Women's Conference. Mercer is a global human resource consulting firm that is committed to helping organizations create environments that employees can thrive. This means creating inclusive, innovative work experiences where all employees can realize their full potential and growth. Our most recent research can be downloaded on Mercer.com, and it is entitled Accelerating for Impact, the 2018 Gender Inflection Point. This research was recently released at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, just a couple of weeks ago. And it serves as a very practical guide to insights into what really works in terms of accelerating the advancement of women. It is therefore my pleasure to introduce today to you a woman who has a lot to say on this topic. Named one of the top 10 women to watch in tech by Inc. magazine is an accomplishment in and of itself. But Dr. Ming is also an accomplished entrepreneur, author, and theoretical neuroscientist. Her most recent startup, SoCoast, is using artificial intelligence to improve the lives of children. And because she writes and speaks frequently on the topic of diversity, innovation, and the future of work, we are very fortunate to have her here today. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. Vivian Ming.
Thank you. As some of you may have intuited, I brought my kids along with me, and I'm having a little challenge. Thank you very much. It was interesting, in the sciences themselves, seeing how many conferences in women-dominated fields had no childcare available and thinking, all right, are we really serving ourselves well here? But, you know, I also respect that I'm in a place of privilege in my life. I get to drag them around and, you know, places that might otherwise say you can't bring your kids in just have to kind of take it or they don't get me. So that's the way life is sometimes. And although my son is just zoning out here, my daughter is occasionally peeking in with real anger in her face. So forgive me if I might have to run over every now and then and check in on her. Diversity. So you, at an event like this, you probably get a lot of talks with the title, with diversity in the title. And you probably expect to hear a lot of the same stuff. And you know, it won't shock you to know that I'm not going to get up here and give you a sort of James Damore-esque read about the evils of diversity. Obviously, I'm a big believer, and one of the things that one of my many companies have been involved in, we've had taglines like taking bias out of the hiring process, and my current company, a think tank, inclusion is one of the specific areas that we tackle in terms of what is the future of human potential and what sort of organizations are going to be able to figure this out in a way that will make them essentially, you know, people think of the new monopolies, like data is a new monopoly. Well, talent, I think, it will quickly, creative talent, will become a new monopoly. And in fact, it's likely the defining competitive, global competitive advantage in the world going forward. In a world where jerks like me start building little AIs that start doing a lot of our everyday job, there's not going to be a lot to distinguish one company from another. Oh, we have, you know, the best financial analyst doing risk assessment on our plans. Well, now everybody does for a fraction of the cost that anyone else does, pays. So that's not it. It's about what people can do that's different, that's exciting. This is just a general tenet and belief of mine. I have a couple of books coming out. One is called How to Robot-Proof Your Kids. I put it in terms of kids because I think about that a lot and I do work in education. But really, it's about how do we build a person for a world in which we don't know what the world will be like, where uncertainty is the fundamental. The game isn't predicting exactly what it will be. It will be building people for uncertainty. And the other book is called The Tax on Being Different. And that's a little bit more about what I'm going to be talking about today. Turns out not a lot of people have used artificial intelligence and machine learning to really go into questions of what is the actual cost of being different in the world. And what are the economic benefits for companies that figure it out? It's probably not surprising that they don't, because I'd like you all to now envision a machine learning deep neural network researcher in your mind. It's very likely that you're not envisioning the sort of breadth of people we have in this room. They are overwhelmingly male and young, not exclusively white, but certainly there are many groups that are not represented there. And, you know, in a sense, we're turning over a lot of the future of our organizations to people whose sole professional experience is how to twiddle with complex metaparameters in an artificial intelligence, but know nothing about hiring. They know nothing about people. They are not Harry Potter. They're not going to do magic and solve those problems. So here's another approach, and I'm going to start with an anecdote. So my first time as an entrepreneur was somewhat interesting. I started life as a scientist, most recently at UC Berkeley. And my wife and I had this idea. She nowadays, she runs research for the San Francisco school system, but at the time she was also at Berkeley at the Ed School. And we had this idea for an education technology. And we thought, is this an experiment or is this a company? And I'd never really done a company before. I had, I'm gonna mention it in a moment, but in terms of the big tech sort of startup scene, this was new to me. It was like, I don't know, whatever, 12 years ago. And we decided it was a company. And we're gonna go found this thing and it will be amazing. And the technology genuinely, if I may be so bold, it was amazing. We were trying to build AIs that could end the reliance on high-stakes testing. If we could actually watch a child while they learn, I mean, some of this is a little intrusive, but have a microphone in the classrooms, analyze their writing. Turns out we published a bunch of papers showing we could do, we couldn't just approximate a standardized test. We could do better than it. And we could tell you on week three that your students would fail specific questions on the final exam without ever looking at the final exam. So wouldn't that be amazing if we could take that kind of well-known bias that's in high-stakes tests off the table and let kids just learn and turn the learning into the assessment? That was our thing, amazing technology, published research, and I go out to the world. And we found a co-founder who is an amazing guy. And we go to VCs, and it was brutal. I mean, it was so hard. First-time entrepreneur trying to raise money. But we got there. In fact, when we got to the first partner vote, it was five guys. I've raised actually a lot of money for my companies. I have never pitched a female partner. I know many, but I've never pitched a female partner in my whole life, which means that's 60 people, and there's never been a woman final decision maker in the room. So we get up there, and we do our pitch. And, you know, it's five-person panel. It's one of those ones where it has to be unanimous. So I get the first question, and it's tough. And then I get the next question, and it's brutal. And then the next one is just like eviscerating. And then the next one, and it's like, geez, what did I ever do to your family? It's just, you know, if you've done this for a little while, you get it. They're kicking the tires. They're going hard. But that first time, you're like, wow. And then the final guy says, you should be so proud of what you've done. That's his only real comment, although he did pat me on the head as I was leaving the room. An interesting experiment. So for the male aspiring or actual entrepreneurs in the room, if you've ever wondered if it's different for being a man and a woman, just ask yourself whether you've ever been patted on the head. So actually, let's do a little time travel, like 6 years into the future. And I am watching a TED Talk. I'm not despite the fact of giving a lot of talks in my life, I'm not a big conference goer. I don't spend a lot of time on TED Talks. But this one was highly recommended. I highly recommend it. I'm about to ruin it for you. The title is, Why Do All Ambitious Women Have Flat Heads? And the speaker is a woman named Dame Stephanie Shirley. She founded one of the first computer science companies in the world back in the 60s. And took all of those women that were human computers and used to be secretaries, and they, a lot of the standards we use in programming languages today were developed at this company. She's very wealthy now and really laid the groundwork for all this. She is a dame. And she gives this talk, Why All Ambitious? So the punchline comes about halfway through the talk. And she says, it's from all the time men pat you on the head and say you should be so proud of what you've done. And I hear that and I'm thinking, that's exactly what that motherfucker said to me. I was so angry. And I admit, in the moment, what I was actually thinking was, at least one of them's on my side. Well, guess who was the one person that voted against funding us? And I've learned that along the way, that is the signal. That's the signal of disengagement. If I feel like, wow, does this one want to fund me or like bounce me on his knee, this is a big problem. And you may think, you know, what do you know? How would you have perspective on whether this is really different than it is for other? Maybe he does occasionally pat guys on the head. Well, I do have one previous experience long ago. So I have a somewhat interesting and colorful life because it turns out when I was much younger, I was very unhappy. I was a smart enough kid, and people have a lot of expectations. But I barely made it out of high school without flunking out. Thanks to standardized tests, I got into some good colleges, and then I did. And I flunked out, and I was homeless for many years. And amazingly, before being homeless, but after flunking out, someone asked me to start a company with them. A film company, of all things. Not to badmouth anyone here who's in the entertainment industry, but if there's a scammier industry than that, I don't know what it is. And we were part of it. It was sell the sizzle time. We'll put your names, we'll put your niece in the film, and we'll put your names in the credits. Like, that's how you sell that stuff. And it was easy. It turned out we got on the phone, called people up. A college flunk out with no experience and no actual thing to sell. And that, 15 years later, with an amazing product, and now I've got multiple PhDs and all fancy credentials, amazing co-founders, and it's pulling teeth. And there's a lot of things that might be different between the two, but they tend to say it should have been easier, not harder. But the main difference, if it's not completely obvious to you, is the first time I was a man and the second time I was a woman. And it's hard to get away from I got on the phone with a certain voice and a certain privilege, and people trusted me. I think wrongly. Like, boy, they would have really lost their money. So what does it feel like when you go through your life with people patting you on the head? And, you know, telling you, you know, oh, you should be so proud of what you've done, rather than actually challenging you at the level at which you're working. And I had this happen right away. I transitioned. I was a scientist during my transition. And if you happen to be in the last session I was at, like literally overnight, people that knew me before stopped asking me math questions. You know, I had published papers of new algorithms I'd invented, and it used to be people, students would come and say, oh, I got this new algorithm, and here's the convergence proof, and what do you think we could do with it? Nope, I was the house psychologist after that. I do happen to have a PhD in psychology also, but that wasn't what was going on. And so in some ways, I'm not saying it's magic. I'm always, as a scientist, I'm skeptical of anecdotes. But it gives me a different perspective. One, because if you may have picked up the subtle hint, I pretty much wrecked my life at one point. So I started from privilege, and I burned it. And I started over again. And it gives me a very different perspective on the world. So in all the things we're going to run through, and I apologize again for starting a bit late. Some of it may go a little fast. Why am I doing this? It would be really easy to look at this as like, hey, what this problem really needs is a good white person sort of approach to the world. But it isn't. I look at everything I've done in the last 12, 15 years of my life, and if I may set aside my modesty, it's amazing. I get to count my life in terms of how many other people are alive, not a couple of them. My son was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and I developed an AI to treat it. And now that I gave it away, and now it's being used to develop new technologies around the world. We built a system for bipolar disorder. and gave it away. It predicts weeks ahead of time, just based on your mobile phone, whether you're about to have a manic episode. I've started many companies. I would challenge anyone, I realize this isn't a panel about being transgender, but I would challenge anyone to say I'm not a better person in every way than the person I was before. Thank you. And in fact, that's the only thing that I think actually matters. Are you a better person? And that's what it boils down to. And I, emotionally, I own that failure in my life. I own all of my failures emotionally. Intellectually, though, particularly given my work in education, I think this is the person that we eventually got, but they slipped through the cracks in the system, despite all white, male, I wasn't wealthy, but well off. My dad was a doctor, my mother was a teacher, coastal California, every advantage, and it was all gone. What would the world be like if people like me didn't slip through the cracks? And when I say people like me, I don't mean white and, at one point in my life, male. I mean anyone that has potential and it isn't realized. I wrote a piece a while ago called If Kids Were Bonds, They'd Be the Backbone of the World Economy. And we looked at if we simply took published research that showed how you can make a difference in a kid's life, and overwhelmingly, these are kids from underserved communities, we found it would add 10% to the US GDP. That's $1.5 trillion a year to the US GDP, 60% to the South African, 110% to the Indian economy. We leave that on the table. Raj Chetty, who I referenced in my last talk, is an economist just up the road. He just had a series of papers out about lost Einsteins, looking at exactly the same issues. And I feel this viscerally. What would this world be like if all of us had the opportunity to be the fullest person that we were born to be? And unfortunately, the forces that work against that start virtually on day one. And one of the biggest predictors of where you will end up in your life is your postal code that you were born in. And that is a truly disturbing thing. All right, so let's get into, I hope I don't have to do a password or something. There we go. So I am a neuroscientist, and as a neuroscientist, I really love this little piece of research on chameleons for understanding bias. And the reason I'm so interested in this particular chameleon and bias is because that's not a chameleon, that's two naked women. So if you didn't see that right away, you're not a bad person, right? You are not a villain because you saw a chameleon. That was the intention of the artist that made this. What's amazing, go look up chameleon body paint online. This is just a still out of a video. The chameleon literally crawls along the stick, and it still looks like a chameleon. They did an amazing job. If you can't tell, the little crest on the head is a foot, and then the tail is the foot of the other woman, and they're laying sort of on top of each other. We have a strong bias towards seeing things that are behaviorally relevant. And in an evolutionary context, looking at things that might bite us or we might want to take a bite out of is really useful. We don't go through the world thinking, you know, is that predator actually two naked women with body paint on them? Now, on the other hand, of course, if you were at a body painting convention and you texted your friend about this enormous chameleon that they had up on stage, you know, that might be worth a diagnosis as well. But I like to start with this because I don't think anyone here sees a moral judgment being made. We have a bias, a very reasonable bias to perceiving the world in certain terms. And in fact, it turns out, again, I have a fairly interesting perspective on issues of inclusion and diversity coming from the machine learning world. There is a mathematical fundamental in our work. It's called the bias variance trade-off. The better you are at generalizing to the world, the worse you do at understanding specific instances, and vice versa. And then it's a fundamental. It is inescapable. I cannot build, nor can anyone, an unbiased artificial intelligence. There are no unbiased rats in the world. And there are no unbiased people. Period. We're not bad because we're biased. The problem is when you refuse to acknowledge it and do anything about it. When you refuse to see that the way you're moving through the world is actually making it worse. So I have this line, discrimination isn't done by villains, it's done by us. And I am not saying there are no villains in the world. We've all been there. I already mentioned that I lost my position at Stanford, or if I didn't, there you go. And I wasn't thrilled about that decision or the comment that the person made at the time, which is, you've lost your edge. Okay. Shall I refer now to the five companies I founded since then? But it was right there in your face. So you have moments like that, and I get it. But the truth is, most of what's going on is unintended. And I'm saying this in a quirky way. I'm saying even the people that are very intentional in their bias, they are explicitly racist and explicitly sexist, still don't innately feel that they're doing something wrong. They think that's the way the world is. And that's really hard to get around. As soon as you start calling people villains, the conversation ends. And unfortunately, if the conversation ends, the people on top won. So you've made no progress. So let me start with a piece of research. I was the chief scientist of a company called Guild. And Guild was the one with the tagline, we take bias out of the hiring process. Nowadays, I get asked a lot about, is there a great AI product people should use for hiring? And my answer is no, for the very reason I went through earlier, which is most of these systems are being made by very well-intentioned people that have no idea about how hiring works or who people are or what great talent is. They just think if you throw a great algorithm at a ton of data, good things happen. And that is a ubiquitous misconception about artificial intelligence. We instead built a system. When I got hired to be the chief scientist at Guild, I actually poached out of my own startup. I had never interviewed for a job in my life. I never really have. What the hell do I know about it? Why should I be the chief scientist here? So what I didn't do was whip out my fanciest algorithm, or even my simplest, or even look at the data. I went and read the research. There's 100 years of research on what makes a great employee. And then we started to build a system that took that information about people and applied it to the world. And we built an AI that would say, we built a database of 122 million people, and we looked to say, who will be great on the job? Let's just get this off the table, race, gender, and age. Race and gender just were, they were very predictive of career trajectory, but they were not predictive of quality of work. Age in software engineers is predictive. Older engineers write better code. That's not the noise that Silicon Valley wants to hear, but that's actually the way it is. So we get to run this sort of massive experiment, like 122 million people, to see who's great. What's not predictive? Grades, test scores, university you go to. Bachelor of Computer Science is a modest positive at Stanford. Is a modest positive predictor of your ability as a software developer. Motivation totally overwhelms it. So if I got some signal that you're highly motivated, the fact that you got a Bachelor of Computer Science at Stanford turns out not to mean very much. So a lot of the traditional ways that we do hiring, including the actual skills, of course you need to know how to program to be a programmer, but if you list Python on your resume, how does that distinguish you from anyone else in the world? Turns out none of that stuff was very informative. So we went deep, and I'm going to talk a little bit about what we found a little bit later, about what predicts the most successful employees. What I will say about it right now is it turns out it is just as predictive for 10-year-olds and 4-year-olds. It's the same things are predictive for software developers and salespeople. And so I'll tell you what it is in a little bit. But along the way, I would get these calls. I got a call from the Wall Street Journal. I got to come back to this story later. This may be a little freeform today. I'm just going to roll with some things. So the first, one of the first bits of artificial intelligence I ever saw was the first real-time face tracking system. So you could just set up a camera real-time, and it would track faces. You could put the dollar bill, and it would track Washington. You could throw up the cast of a TV show, and it would find everyone. And they were doing this little demo. It was a guy named Paul Viola from MIT. They threw up a little demo, and in one of the shots that they showed was the crew of the Starship Enterprise. And it didn't recognize one person in the crew. And they were just whipping through the examples. So they didn't stop. And I said, wait. Go back to the Enterprise. It's Uhura. It didn't recognize Uhura. And he confesses, listen, we trained this thing on the internet. This was a long time ago. And it's like, it's overwhelmingly white. So it turns out it doesn't work well with dark skin. We know it. We're going to fix this. Okay. So now we can flash forward every couple of years, and something like this pops up again. I was at Guild when I got a call from the Wall Street Journal. Google, their AI, just labeled a black couple as gorillas. Is artificial intelligence racist? And I said, it's the same thing as for the rest of us. It depends on how you raise it. There was a paper that just came out showing that the face recognition systems, like the ones used by Apple and by Baidu and by all of these companies, do really well on light-skinned men. They do okay on light-skinned women, considerably worse on dark-skinned men, and dark-skinned women, they really start to fall apart. Now we're talking like 20 years apart, and the same problem comes up again and again and again. It's not a technology problem. AI isn't racist. Who's building this stuff? How are they thinking about what's valuable in the world? I know one of the standard arguments for having a diverse team is how will you understand your diverse customer base if you don't? And sometimes I think there are even stronger arguments to be made out there, but here is a perfect one that fits that. Google is substantially, particularly their machine learning terms, are really underrepresented, certainly in terms of blacks, but broadly in terms of dark-skinned people. You will even see this in terms of Asians and South Asians. So what do you think when people that aren't going to experience the problem are building the tool? Of course these things happen. And it's frustrating. One of the funniest, there was a short-lived, very geeky TV show called Better Off Ted. Anyone here geeky enough to know? Okay, there you go. You are worse people for admitting that. But then so am I. I played Dungeons and Dragons when I was young. And my life turned out great, which means all of you should have done so. So they had this one episode in which they replace all the sort of, you know, scanner cards to get in and out of rooms with a face recognition system. And you can probably guess where this is going. It didn't recognize any of the black employees, so they were all trapped in their offices for like days because they couldn't get in and out of their offices. And what I loved was the solution. Yes, it's a sitcom, but I can kind of feel a little bit here. So they hire a bunch of white interns to just follow them around and open the doors for them. And until finally giving up and giving in. And it sounds ridiculous, but then you look at the actual history of face recognition in the world and you see, well, that's not actually all that ridiculous. They've known this problem exists for 20 years and they haven't fixed it because it's not their problem. That was totally off script. So let's go back to Joe and Jose. So I got a call, in this case, USA News and World Report. Hey, we've got this story. This is a blog post written by a guy named Jose Zamora. And he claims that he was sending out 100 resumes a week, not getting any responses. So he takes the S out of his name. And suddenly Joe's getting all these job offers. Jose wasn't. Is this plausible? And I'm like, is it plausible? Like, how many times do you need some scientist to cite what I'm sure all of you have heard before, men in the room included, the copious research on identical resume, male, female name, African-American, Caucasian sounding name. This is, you know, you could call out one single study, but when you see it done again and again and again, you see it done in Europe ZTH, a big university in Switzerland, they took nationality and gender markers off of the graduate student submissions, and suddenly they had a lot more women and Turkish students admitted. So this isn't an American thing, though we all have our profound personal experience with it. It's a very universal. And I was frustrated. Do we have to do this again? J- justify again. In fact, now in retrospect, I can actually cite USA News and World Report articles on those studies. So they ain't even reading their own stuff. It's like we have the memory of mayflies. Here's, in fact, one of my favorites. This was the study that was meant for Silicon Valley. So it started like a very traditional one. You take a work history, in this case, put an identical, you know, identical work history, male, female name at the top. And then they had actual hiring managers decide whether this person should get a promotion, and if so, how much of a raise they should get. Unsurprisingly, the male name is more likely to get a promotion for an identical work history, and when they do, they get a substantially bigger raise. Okay, well, we already know that. So that wasn't the real experiment. That was just setting a baseline. The real experiment is then how much you emphasize meritocracy, right? If this was Hollywood, if the Silicon Valley was Hollywood, we would have meritocracy written three stories high on the San Mateo Hills in white, quite appropriately. How many CEOs have you heard get up on a stage and say, you know, it's all about meritocracy. We just want the best people. And in some sense, they're being true. But the finding in this study was the more you emphasize meritocracy, the worse the bias gets. The more likely the man is to get the promotion, and when he does, he gets an even bigger bonus. And I am a geek, I like numbers, so I got a hold of the data, I did a little modeling. The best description of what's sort of going on, I mean, formally, you're just injecting noise into the system, which requires people to fall back on their priors. What that means is, who's intentionally hiring the wrong people? They have their way that they go about the world. Essentially, what you're telling them is everything you think you know about the world, it's wrong. When you take information away from people, you're supposed to be focusing more on the resume. But in fact, you don't realize it. You're taking information away from them. They fall back even more strongly on their own bias. And in fact, I'll give you another completely unrelated example and then a third prediction. The unrelated example is ban the box. Totally believe in it. There is no correlation between I have been convicted of a felony and performance on the job and any study I'm familiar with. And it overwhelmingly penalizes African-American men. So in a number of places, there have been these big political pushes to ban the box on job applications. And it actually passed in Illinois, and African-American male employment dropped. They took the information away, and what happened? People fell back even more strongly on their bias. Before, they had this cover. He has not been convicted of a felony. Now every black man has. Or at least it starts to influence the decision making. So here's my prediction, and this may sound a little controversial in this room. I firmly believe that women should be paid the same as men, and one of the things that has been demonstrated to play into that is being asked for your past salary history. So now there's a big movement amongst many companies to end that. We're no longer going to ask about past salary history. Guess what I'm about to say? You take information away, people fall back even more strongly on their own biases. My prediction is it will actually decrease women's total earnings. Some might benefit from it, but overall what you'll see is probably a decrease. Totally agree with the outcomes trying to be achieved by all of these systems, but it turns out things that seem like a great idea, emphasizing meritocracy, banning certain types of questions, often have these perverse consequences, which are immensely frustrating. Back to this story. So I didn't just shout at the reporter. I get it. You know, I'm a scientist. You know how many times I've heard people say, psst, research. You can prove anything with research. And I'm like, Mom, you know that's my job, right? So I wish I was just joking. There was a little while where she was like a Fox News quoting machine. And in fact, that's one thing that I think my gender transition really kind of helped with was, oh, maybe not everything they say is true. But I do genuinely get it. These are lab experiments that it's not real world. But I had this database, 122 million people. What did that say? and says some interesting things. If I looked on average, Joe versus Jose, pull them out of our data set. Now, these are professionals, right? 122 million people, but we're only looking at people that had a professional digital footprint in the English language world. So pretty much, actually, probably the majority of what you might think of as the English language creative class globally. And so we get about 150,000 Joes and 100,000 Jose's. Joe, no Joseph, Joe. That's what you say you are on LinkedIn. We're pulling data, though, off of hundreds of different websites. So we got Facebook, Bitbucket, GitHub, personal blogs, Twitter, everything all aggregated together. And then we looked, is there a difference between Joe and Jose? Interestingly, Jose's more likely to be an MD than Joe is. I wouldn't have guessed that, but okay. Joe is four times as likely to be a CEO as Jose, except in DC, where Jose is actually slightly more likely. And obviously, we're talking about the United States and Canada, so it would be very different if we were including Mexico and below. But none of that, you throw out stats like that, and everyone says, apples and oranges. Men and women are different. They make different decisions. Joes and Jose's are different. They make different decisions. But remember, our whole tool was, how good are they at their job? So we could actually equate people on the quality of work that they did. So what happens when you equate? Well, I focus a lot on education, so I started there. And we looked at what does Jose need to get the same probability of a promotion for the same quality of work? And what we found, for example, in the tech industry, is Jose typically needs a master's degree or higher to be competitive, equal probability, as Joe with no degree whatsoever. So it turns out we can actually put a number to that, right? That's 6 years of tuition in a US university context. And we can do a range of tuitions there. And that's 6 years of opportunity cost, right? You weren't getting that software engineering salary. And there's a number then we can come out with, the median of which is $750,000. So the cost of being Jose in the tech industry is $750,000. And probably one of the best ways to think of that, just a quick way, is it's like it's ante. Most of it is paid right up front earlier in your career. Truth is, as you go deeper, as we restrict our analysis to more senior jobs, these numbers blow up. But there's a better way. I had an opportunity to talk to a couple of, at the time, Republican presidential candidates. And I can come to a room like this and talk about the importance of women being in the workplace, and that's great, but the real change happens when you can talk to the third of people that think the whole thing is bullshit and actually change a couple of minds. So how do I change the mind of Jeb Bush and Rand Paul back when people mistakenly thought they were relevant? And I thought, let's call this what it is, at least economically, exactly what it is. Let's give it the dirtiest word in the conservative language. It's a tax. This is the tax on being different. And it's a genuinely good way of thinking about it. I mean, it's hard to make a glass ceiling argument, right? Despite the outcome of the presidential election, which was grotesque, there are female billionaires in the world. There are female CEOs. There aren't many. I'm not saying that. But if there's one, someone's going to say, see, the problem's solved. Right? I'm not saying that I would trade it back, but in some ways, Barack Obama made these debates hard because now people can say, see, there's no problem. And you're like, I feel like we weren't in the same world for the last 8 years. So how do we think about this? Well, okay, everybody can climb Mount Everest, but some of us have to do it with an extra 100 pounds of rocks on our back. Why rocks? Because this tax doesn't pay for roads. It doesn't build bridges. It doesn't pay for defense. It's just heat loss in our economy, which means, ultimately, it is loss by the companies that failed to value people correctly. It is one thing to work really hard to grow. If Jose had to work extra hard to become the amazing person he is, that's great. And I will fully acknowledge these are complicated stories. So one thing I learned as a neuroscientist, however complex you think the brain is, it is more complex than that. And when I started working in education and workforce and inclusion and beyond, I never saw that rule get violated. So there are only messy human problems in the world, and there will only ever be messy human solutions. And if you really wanted me to give you simple answers about things, that's not going to happen here. We can do simple work like this in talking about what are the costs, but what are the solutions is hard. So what is the tax? It gets paid in having to go to more prestigious schools, having to accumulate higher degrees, more exceptional experience, so winning extra awards, and working longer names at higher brand name companies. And in every one of these cases, we can actually build an economic model around what it meant for you to have to take longer, be there, to have to work longer and harder for the same outcomes. And it's, yes, the tax is most directly paid by the person it is levied against. And the sad story here is you cannot buy a shotgun and move to Wyoming and say, I'm not paying this tax. It's just, this isn't an opt-out system. But it is something that societally, organizationally, culturally, we can address and make difference. And so just here are some rough numbers. I gave a talk once in the UK and they asked me what's the tax on being a gay man. That may not seem like a big number. It's about $70,000. But you know, if you think about it, if you went to randomly selected one out of every 10 families in England and you said, you know, at age 5, you're going to have to pay us $5,000 a year and you can't opt out until your son leaves the home, that's going to have an impact on the outcomes of those families. So even if that number looks small, as we know with tax research, those disincentives are profound. There you see Jose. Women in tech, that slide needs to get somewhat updated. That's actually, I'm looking hard at intersectionality and other cultures because I gave a talk in Singapore. We looked at Singapore and Hong Kong lesbians. May not seem like a huge population, but they're there. They're everywhere. My wife's family is from Taiwan, and the one thing I've learned about Taiwan is every family is keeping the same secret from every other family. But you see the numbers start to get big. I mean, really big. Like, if you're, you know, a paraplegic black lesbian, like, you just, there's a manner that we should just give you. But it's profound because it's not just them, right? These are our organizations blowing opportunities to find those lost Einsteins, to create potential in people, to realize it. I am running very short on time. I mentioned this analysis in the last talk, but I'll throw it out there again. I'm not going to have time to go through anyone else, but people can come up and ask questions later. So in this case, as I mentioned in the other room, there's a very common finding about the pay gap. Why are women paid less? And this finding is because of childbearing. So a lot of people, including very progressive economists, Roz Chetty at Stanford, James Heckman at University of Chicago, people I really respect and whose work I rely on for a lot of my research, say, you know, we looked hard at this and it's because of childbearing. By the way, it doesn't matter whether you rear a child or not, you will pay the tax, but it's because of childbearing. And I looked at that and I thought, I mean, there's two big problems with that. One is it's what, it's not why. Why did women make this choice? Are we to believe that this very smart young woman worked hard all through school, got into a great university, got top grades, worked incredibly hard, got a, you know, junior executive job at a top company, and only now realizes, I'm sorry, I gotta leave, I'm supposed to raise a family. In fact, we see wildly different. Some companies, there is, they call them pipeline problems, which to me is really eventually just blaming it on some 3-year-old girl that she wasn't interested enough in STEM. But you know, you look at these sorts of things and you realize there's a why. Some companies, many women stay in the system and work hard and move up. Other companies, I mean, a lot of them, literally none do. So what's different between them? So I built a little AI, and I had it crawl through the websites of 60,000 companies, and we looked at a lot of variables. But far and away, the biggest predictor of the tax was how many women were in those pictures. pictures of the leadership team. That is, it was the leadership team for Royal Dutch Shell. If you look at their board, there are a couple of women there what I sometimes call academic roles. So they are all the heads of various academic institutions playing sort of governance roles. It's always good to have a couple of women there to make certain people don't blow the company up. So one thing you get with an all-male board and C-suite, well demonstrated in the literature, substantially higher risk of catastrophic failure, usually due to malfeasance or bad acquisition. So what's going on here? And I could go into this in detail, but I think I'm almost out of time. Turns out when we actually build a model to understand this, what we see is best described as, remember that story of that young woman who worked so hard and suddenly got there and then made this inexplicable decision to leave and raise a family? Well, it wasn't inexplicable. She got to her company, and if you remember the tax on being different research, all through school and into the company, she's working harder than her peers for worse outcomes. And then she looks up, and there's no one like her in top leadership. And she starts asking herself, why am I working so hard at this? I've got other choices I can make. I could take a job at another company. And Jesus, my mom and my family, they don't want me to raise a family. My husband has a good job. Why don't I just go do that? So turns out that's how these decisions get made. In the boring language of behavioral economics, it's called belief-based utility. Do I believe that my hard work will pay off? And let me put it in the context of some of my education work in South Africa. As someone who builds fancy-smancy technology, Silicon Valley in particular is enamored with this idea that you invent some new technology or, you know, an iPhone game that supposedly makes people smarter, and then you have succeeded. That's it. You won. Or better yet, a million people are paying for it. Well, are you actually making a difference in their lives? Why are they paying for it? Do the kids that are getting this actually need extra help? So the way I like to put it in South Africa is 20 years post-apartheid, if your grandmother was cleaning some white woman's clothes and your mother is cleaning some white woman's clothes and so are you, why would you possibly believe it would be any different for your daughter? They could go to Khan Academy and watch all those videos. They could have these aspirations. But why would you believe that it's true? And it turns out this isn't about gender, and it isn't about race. If you were in the last session, this is my dad, straight white guy from Kansas, grew up on a farm in the middle of nowhere. You know, he used to go and shit in a hole. It was, you kick the tumbleweeds out of the way to see where he farmsteaded. And in 1957, he wrote an essay as a junior in high school about how Israel would be the defining foreign policy issue in the world going forward. He's a pretty smart guy. Got a full scholarship, 5-year non-performance based to MIT, and he didn't go. In the words of my grandparents, what's the point of going to MIT if you're just going to end up back on the farm? If you don't understand why people make their choices, you cannot possibly make a difference. Nor can you possibly value other people correctly. If you see women not choosing to lean in and you think, well, they don't got it. They're not A players. They're not ninjas or Jedis or Smurfs or whatever the new thing is. Then there's nothing there for you to latch onto and appreciate. We got to bust that and get around it. So I have, I think, 30 seconds left and a similar number of slides. Just out of curiosity, anybody know who this is? Anyone misspend their youth? It's less likely in a room with this level of estrogen in it. Probably the greatest skateboarder of all time. Ask him what he does. He won 59 world championships in a row. Ask him what he does after his 49th world championship. He goes and practices new moves. I gave a TED talk about this. And one of the things that are predictive of the greatest employees, and we call it endogenous motivation, that drive that comes from within. You're doing it for you, not for the bonus, not for your parents, not to brag to your friends. Huge predictor of how long you'll live, how much you'll earn, how happy you'll be. Go check it out. There's a TED talk I gave about it. This was Guild. This was the cover. We were the cover story of The Atlantic. It was actually a very positive story that they wrote about us. But this is not what I'm getting at. I said there were two problems with the research about pay gap. You know what the biggest problem is? In all of the papers I've ever read about gender representation in the workplace, I have never read a paper that ever included a variable about sexual harassment, ever. How could you possibly think you have an insight about women's experience in the workplace if you have not included sexual harassment as one of the variables you're looking at? I mean, I am no looker, and yet I had the experience for the first time when I'm talking to one of my employees, and it's like, are you really staring at my chest? What? I'm your boss. It was unbelievable. You know how many times I have had a very ambitious young computational scientist come up to me and explain my own algorithms to me? So this is the things that are predictive about life outcomes. When we're done with that, ask me questions if you want to know. I'm writing a book, How to Robo-Proof Your Kids. We'll go into all the details. I will simply leave this as a punchline. The future of work, this is the defining competitive advantage I see globally around the world, is talent. And there will only be one job description, a creative, adaptive problem solver. In fact, problem identifier is an even better way of putting it. And we track 50 different constructs. That's what that last slide about, looking in detail about this. In little kids, in men, in women, in employees around the world, the same things are predictive. It's these qualities. It's not whether they know how to program. It's not whether they negotiated for their salary. Why the hell? I get lean in, but why are we paying our software engineers based on how well they negotiate? Did someone do some research that demonstrated that that's the value they add to the company? It's crazy. I actually am skeptical that it's actually predictive for salespeople. This is too much. I'm just looking for an end here. I do a lot of cool work. If anyone wants to talk about it, come talk to me afterwards. But let me end with this one. It was a quote that I said once. I threw it away, and then someone wrote it up on the walls at the latest Grace Hopper conference, and I was very flattered by that. Ambitious men are promising us a future of spaceships and AIs and cybernetics. If every little girl had been given the reins to her own potential, we'd already have them. And imagine we're not just talking about every little girl, but every little kid that could grow up and get to do the kinds of things that I do, but they never had the chance. What would that world be like? That's the world I'm trying to build. Those are the companies we should all be trying to build. And here I will leave it with this. It's not meant to be pessimistic. It's meant to be very realistic. It is always diversity, inclusion, will always come with short-term costs. If you are not ready to pay those costs, to build psychological trust, to build communication on your teams, you will never reap the benefits. But those benefits are profound. And if you don't chase those long-term payoffs, eventually you'll be working for someone else. Thank you very much. Happy to, sure, yeah.